I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to the best of Ring of Fire.
Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Daniel Ellsberg will be here to discuss the domestic spying programs of the federal government. Former CIA attorney John Rizzo will be here to tell us about some of the most secretive activities of our federal government. Author and journalist Joe Connison will tell us why Republicans are so terrified of Pope Francis. Author David Bromwich will tell us why many of President Obama's campaign promises have fallen flat over the years. And Dr. Tom Schneider will join us to discuss his new book, A Physician's Apology. You can follow Ring of Fire on Facebook or on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. And you can keep up with the latest progressive news on our website at ringoffireradio.com. And now you can tune into Ring of Fire every Sunday at noon on Free Speech TV. And make sure you catch me, Sam Cedar, 3 to 6 daily on the new Ring of Fire weekday program. And if you want to help support Ring of Fire, go online to ringoffireradio.com/support to find out how.
The medical profession has become an extension of Big Pharma. Rather than fixing problems or even preventing them, they're trained to push as many pills as possible. Joining me now to talk about this problem is Dr. Tom Schneider. Tom, listen. If we take a look at the state of the world with Big Pharma calling all the shots, it scares the hell out of me as an attorney because I see the other side of it. I see how dishonest this industry's become, corrupt in every way. What's your take? I mean, I don't want to overstate it. Is that an overstatement?
No, I think it's an understatement, Mike, and thanks so much for having me. I love it. I love being here. Big Pharma, to me, there's two sides. There's the double-edged sword. The one sword is that we put it down, got to put Big Pharma down. The other side is that it does have an aspect of help. I take medications. The problem is the facts. We don't give out the truth or the facts or the information to the consumer to be able to protect himself. And I'm going to tell you, as you know this fact, we've talked about it. How many people did we kill last year? We, physicians, giving medications out.
Yeah, put that in terms of, say, a nuclear blast.
Right, right. So it's I give the example of a 747 carries 300 people, and if I told you that they literally lost 30 of them last year, you know, or 300 of them last year, would you sit there and go, I think I'll walk to California. I don't want to take that 747. So that's effectively what we did. We killed 100,000 people last year, and we've done that for the last 10 years. Now, that's kill. We've maimed or injured over a million.
When you say maimed, you're talking about the drug industry here, and you are somebody who is spoken out about the drug industry. Let me go through the problems that after reading your book, and by the way, Tom, it is so well done. And you're talking to somebody who confronts the drug industry every day.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, I'm taking a deposition this week and next week and the week after that on these national cases against this drug industry. Now, here you have the thing that I've seen develop, and I guess you've watched it develop, is the creation of the biostitute. The biostitute is the scientist who will say anything you want them to say for the pharmaceutical industry for the right amount of money. And you can find them in any university. They're paid a couple $100,000 in the university to be a biostitute for somebody like Merck or Pfizer or Glaxo, hell, they make $500,000. So tell me the impact of the biostitute.
So it's huge because, unfortunately, what we deal with on a practical level is the average physician, the guy that gets up and the gal that gets up in the morning, goes into the office, and may and probably does want to do the best for their patient. They absolutely do. That's not who we're talking about. We're talking about the scientist physician or the associated scientist physician with the university, who is exactly as you've said, being paid for a particular study, or more importantly, let me put it to you this way, a particular result. Mm. And that information doesn't get down to the busy get up in the morning physician who's going in to see 30 patients. he takes the word of the pharmaceutical rep, who's usually cute, was a cheerleader at University of North Carolina, and
has cupcakes for him, right?
Absolutely.
Doc, here's the cupcakes. Let me don't even worry about the right. all the bad stuff with his drug. Just eat the cupcake,
That's
and
right.
life is going to be good. Now, let me shift to something else. I took a series of depositions in Europe a couple of months ago on a case that I'll be trying this year, Pradaxa, which is a blood thinner that's killing people by the hundreds.
Oh yeah.
It's produced by a company called Boehringer Ingelheim over in Germany.
Yes.
And that we're seeing more and more of that, European countries coming over here to the U.S., A, because they can sell their product for more money in the United States, and B, they can kill people and get away with it because the FDA is so dysfunctional. But what I saw in that deposition was that the company, and we see this very often, you'll see a company make a determination of how many people they can kill and mm-hmm. still make a profit.
No, that's absolutely
at
true.
The end. In other words, if they're selling $10 billion worth of the product a year, they can sell, in 1 year they can pay off they can pay off all the dead people for, $1 billion, and they've made $9 billion. And when you don't throw them in jail for that, life goes on. Isn't that kind of, do you see that firsthand?
Absolutely. And, things are going to happen, but I am not the angry physician yelling out. I'm also the patient. I don't think there's a listener out there that's had as many diseases as I have, and I'm not proud of that, but I've had them all. And, for example, I took an NSAID, something that anybody else would take, a Motrin, a Celebrex. Years ago when I was running, I took one. And it perforated my intestine, and I spent 3 months in an ICU from a perforated bowel. Hmm. Now, this medication has been known to do that before, and when the representatives came to me, you have to have a certain amount of failure. Some people are going to bleed. Some people are going to die. And I said to them, what's an acceptable number? And they said, about 30 per 100,000. What do you think of that? And I said, I think one is too many.
Hey, Tom, can you stay with me?
Yeah.
Do you have time to stay with me? Because we just scratched the surface on this. I'm Mike Papantonio. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to the best of Ring of Fire. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. I have Dr. Tom Snyder in the studio with me, and we're discussing the problems with the medical profession and the influence that's being wielded by Big Pharma. Tom, Dr. Snyder, let me just ask you this. There was a time when a CEO used to stay with a drug company they'd be there 25 years. They'd start their career there and they'd end their career there. Now what you have is a process called big profits, big risks. And the CEO is going to be there for 5 years. They're going to move through. They're going to take and extract everything they can from that drug company. And they're going to take their profits, take their big bonuses in 5 years, and they're going to go home and leave all the death and all the destruction to the next CEO. Don't you see that? As a matter of fact, you touched a little bit about that same or similar topic in your book. What's your thought?
No, I couldn't agree more, Mike. You're so on. And it really does come down to the bucks. So you've got a major pharmaceutical company that has a drug, and they are going to push it, and they're going to push it with very attractive pharmaceutical reps to the local doc. No offense to the male pharmaceutical reps that are out there, but that's what we're seen by. And the book, A Physician's Apology, is really meant as an instruction guide for patients to say, listen, if you go to see your physician and all you leave with is a prescription, find another doctor. Because although you and I are talking about pharma, Mike, and I fully understand that. We have to also at least infringe on the physician's part here, because physicians today are taught make a diagnosis and give the medication that's required for it. And that's obviously, better than I, not the way to do it.
Well, there's so many parts to this. A good example is your discussion about statins.
Oh, yeah.
Now, okay, so we see this report come out 4 or 5 years ago. We've got to lower cholesterol below 200 to now, the number then became 160. You got to get lower than that. Then the next thing we find out is that women that have a cholesterol level below 200 were at a higher cardiac risk.
Correct.
Then we find out that not only is that bad, we find out that statins basically are poisoning people, and you don't have any discussion that starts really surfacing in the important journals, because the pharmaceutical industry controls the journals too, don't they?
They absolutely do. And your topic of the statin is so poignant, because in fact, I tell patients, if you're being given a statin, or really this applies to any medication, but particularly a statin, you need to ask your physician, what's it going to do for me? Well, it's going to lower your cholesterol under 200. Is there a study that says that's worthwhile? And the answer is no. There are lots of studies, but are there valid studies? And the answer is no. The total cholesterol is not a factor. I tell my patients, what kind of fat is cholesterol? Is it good or bad? They go, oh, I think it's both. No, it's not even a fat. Cholesterol is not a fat. It is choline, liver, steroid. It's what makes your testosterone, progesterone. So you lower that, and you're going to lower your testosterone, your estrogen, your progesterone, and you're also going to have to say, or should be saying to your physician, what are the side effects here?
Here's the real problem, one of the very many real problems, but it is that when we take a drug, we believe the FDA has done testing on it.
Right.
Okay, the FDA has not tested it at all.
No.
Most of the time, the FDA doesn't even know what the hell's going on until the drug, 3 years later, starts killing people by the thousands. I tell you that firsthand. It is absolutely the truth, because I handle these cases. Now, what they did, I've seen study after study, where they go in and they find out how influenced has the FDA been to lie? How influenced has the FDA been to cover up clinical data that was all bad for a particular drug and then say, we're going to sell the drug anyway? 61% of respondents in one survey that knew cases, directly new cases, where the Department of Health and Human Services and the FDA had political appointees that inappropriately put themselves into the FDA determination as to whether or not the drug should stay on the market or be granted on the market. All that is it's money.
It's all money.
You have a politician calling, putting pressure on somebody in the FDA, or somebody in the FDA is going to go get a job from Merck or Pfizer. You have Pfizer meeting with the FDA folks all the time, talking to them all the time, saying, you know, Joe, how would you like to come to work and make an extra $300,000 a year when you come to work with us? How do we have any confidence in the FDA?
No, I have none. And what's scary is, I mentioned this because we have listeners out there that this applies to at our level. Never mind the university researchers, at our level. And I would venture to bet that there isn't a single listener right now that's on a statin, that's a cholesterol-lowering medicine, a Lipitor, a Crestor, or any of the other names that are down there, Prevacol. There isn't a single one that when they were given that drug by their physician was told, your risks from this medication are diabetes type 2, increased risk of breast cancer for women, increased risk of prostate cancer for men, and 85% of you will have cognitive delay. You'll be walking around in a fog. But please take it, because I need your cholesterol under 200. And oh, by the way, we have no studies that that's going to save your life.
It's almost like a mania, isn't it? A report comes out and says, gee, take the statin, it's going to save your life. That's followed up by a slick ad campaign by Madison Avenue hustlers that make you believe that if you don't take the statin, you're going to be dead tomorrow. And then all of a sudden, it's almost as if overnight, statin is the new black.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a study about 6 months ago that said we need to be giving these to children.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Children.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, the cases that I've handled, of course, as you know, I handled the FinFin litigation. We handled the Vioxx, the same thing. We actually led the discovery with that. You know, we're doing the same thing with half a dozen other drugs, right, whether it's Actos, whether it's transvaginal mesh, whether it's Pradaxa. We see the same story every single time, and that is the drug company doesn't really care whether or not they stay on the market after the point that they've made a big profit. And here's what they know. Once the FDA allows them to sell the product, the chances of having that product pulled from the market is less than 10%.
Oh, yeah.
So they know that, look, we'll phony up clinicals, we'll do everything we can to distort the truth up front. Then when our product gets on the market, it's going to be very difficult for them to pull a product like Actos, for example. It's going to be very difficult for them to pull it. Mm-hmm. And we see that happening right now. I see it all the time.
But it's not just the person that's listening right now, not our listener. It's everyone. So I'm a physician. I'm boarded in 5 specialties, and I also am diabetic. My physician convinced me about a year and a half ago that Victoza, and I'm not putting down one particular drug, but this is the truth, Victoza, a brand new medication better than insulin, would work wonderfully. And I did, and I took it. It turns out that Victoza has a side effect. It causes pancreatitis and hepatitis. And so, as you know, from January until May of this past year, I spent in an ICU having intra-abdominal surgery, intravenous medications to try and quiet this down.
Well, isn't the thing, I mean, at very least, we should give people a choice. We
Absolutely.
Should say, look, here are the facts.
Yeah.
If you take this, you might get pancreatitis, you might get liver cancer, you might, you know, you may have a DVT, a blood clot, you may, but here it is. Matter of fact, as you know, we handled the Yaz case. That was the
Sure.
case that killed so many women in America. Yaz was a birth control pill that you had Bayer Corporation selling it as something far beyond a birth control pill. They were doing something called off-label marketing where they sold it to women telling that if you take this, if you take, and all it was a birth control, but if you take this birth control, it's going to cure your acne, it's going to solve your PMS problems, and we are the birth control with extra. What they didn't tell women was if you take this birth control, you have a 60% higher risk than the normal person taking competitive birth controls for dying from a blood clot.
Absolutely. And the marketing for that was so good, I wanted to take Yaz. I mean, it's that
well,
good.
Yeah, I mean, we see it repeatedly. This is a story that repeats itself time and time again because there are no adults running the program with the FDA.
And it would be nice if we could demand that for each drug that comes out or each drug that's given to you or me as a patient has what I call an RB ratio, a risk to benefit ratio. Tell me exactly what they are and tell me what the benefit is again. I want to know that. Now, if you do that to most of the medications that are out there right now, you would take nothing. Risk to benefit ratio, very, very important. What's the risk of a statin? Oh my God. What's the benefit? Minimal.
What about my advice that I give people? Don't take it unless it's been out there for 10 years.
Oh, the best ever. Anything under 10 years is crazy.
Dr. Tom Snyder is the author of the new book, A Physician's Apology. You can find it on our website at ringoffireradio.com. Just ahead, author David Bromwich is going to be here to explain what happened to Obama, what made him forget about all those campaign promises he made. I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to Ring of Fire. Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. During his 2008 campaign, Americans were positive that Barack Obama was going to lead this country in a new direction, one that was completely different from the 8 dark years before him. But 6 years into this presidency, very little has changed, and those campaign promises from 2008 are just really a distant memory. Join me now to explain what happened as David Bromwich, author of the new book, Moral Imagination. So, David, who is this guy? Don't you, you know, it's kind of one of those questions you wake up and you say, there's a stranger in the room. Who is this? I mean, that's the kind of reaction I get constantly on this show.
Yeah, I think he is a strange person, and he is a strange person by the usual ways of judging, you know, one's fellow human beings socially in any context. Not the strangest to have become president. I think Nixon's still farther out than that. But I don't think he's a stranger. I think that the basic facts about his biography, as we know them, are pretty plain. And I think the fundamentals of his ideology are clear, too, and are pretty much as he presented them in the general election campaign, not in the primaries, where he was looking to move to the left of Hillary Clinton, but in the general election, they stayed pretty much what they were then. But he is not someone who has a talent for politics or who ever had much interest in politics as we understand it, which involves a couple of abilities and competences that are very remote from Obama's character. One is a fighting contest as such, realizing that you have real enemies and that you've got to outflank them in some way. And the other is bargaining. You know, first person getting into the thick of it, bargaining with Congress, bargaining with opponents, bargaining with people who ought to be your friends. He just doesn't have
Well, David, let me tell you, somebody who's been through law school and had my share of constitutional law professors and
right.
professors of every kind, I do understand that persona.
Right.
And I saw the persona. But I have to tell you, even as I was watching Obama in the primaries, I said, well, he's a little different. Whatever the narrative is a little different from what I'm seeing, what I had been so used to seeing in law school. And, of course, I've practiced law for 30 years, so it's not that I'm unaware of some of the trades you're talking about. But I think the thing that people now are realizing, I think more and more, is that when you drill down and you follow the money on this person and the candidate in the primaries, you start understanding, well, he kind of did come out of nowhere. You know, all of a sudden we start seeing Robert Rubin money behind him. We start seeing Penny Pritzker money behind him. We start seeing Wall Street money behind him. He's this perfect candidate that it seems very easy to kind of gain control of. And I can't help but think there's some element of that.
Yeah, I think you're right that his attraction over time, but, you know, getting pretty heavy in 07 when we didn't hear about it, and in 08 when he picked his economic team from out of the Goldman Sachs hit parade. I mean, I think at that time, those associations and putting those people in positions of power hemmed him in. And I mean, let's not place him as the victim in this. They committed him to support for a lot of the existing structures that weren't part of his campaign. At the same time, I think that this man, partly because of the peculiar charmed life he had, actually believed that you could have it both ways, that he could have the Wall Street people in there tight and at the same time persuade them to do something more rigorous, say, than the Dodd-Frank reform, and that he could do it by force of personality and rallying the popular forces behind him even while he had Wall Street in his corner. I think having it both ways is part of what his life has been, and you know, he thought of it that way. But you know,
in other words, he's gotten by with that formula. That is, that it's a contradiction in many ways, but that formula is, I'm a little bit of this and I'm a little bit of that in the way that I view the world and the way that I interact.
Look how often he uses the phrase "all of the above." You know, we ordinary citizens of life know that you can't have all the above. X doesn't go with not X.
Yeah.
But in his world, Penny Pritzker goes with the most noble-minded black school teacher, agitator in favor of public education in Chicago. But no, it doesn't work like that.
David, isn't, I mean, if you really think about it, and I've, you know, of course, haven't done media, television, radio on this issue for years. I mean, I was the guy on Fox News that was the liberal having to beat back three crazy people about Obama. And I think the thing that I think we were all kind of overtaken with was his ability to speak. I mean, to eloquently give a great vision of where America should be. His ability to give us this picture that we could visualize was a John F. Kennedy kind of message that he knew how to deliver.
Yeah,
and then you'd look behind it. Within 40 days, it was meaningless.
Yeah, it's in his face, which is an unusually, I don't know what how to put
no,
it.
No, it's a kind face.
Kind, and it seems attentive and to take things in. You know, again, a contrast with Bush, who had that sort of closed, defensive, whatever you want to call
it.
You know, there's that, and then there's, yeah, there's the attempt and reach of the words. I mean, myself, I've heard the word eloquent and soaring words used a lot about Obama. I don't think it's hindsight. I seldom found his words to be as such, if you read them cold on the page, to be so remarkable, with one exception of the speech he gave in response to the attack on his association with Jeremiah Wright. The speech he gave during the campaign on race, that was out of the ordinary. That was an unusually closely argued and remarkable speech. It is it's a voice, and it's a style of presentation that's very assuring and reassuring. But I think when you look at it, and especially starting around, you know, early 2010, I mean, the amount of platitude, the amount of sheer optimistic banality in his speaking is, you know, right up there with Reagan and Clinton.
Well, somebody recognized that, David. Somebody recognized that. His handlers recognized it. That's where they attach change and hope and
right.
We
oh,
can.
Yeah.
That is, I thought it was very, your take on, by the way, your work on this is superb. Okay, you're talking to a guy that's followed him from day one as being a huge advocate, from defending him on virtually every network I can think of, to now saying, you know, how could I have been so wrong? But there are a lot of people out there just like me, if they're honest with themselves. You see, I think you have this issue of progressives. They're looking for that hero. They're looking for that man who will pull the sword out of the stone and lead them through this next generation.
Yep.
And we're so they're so hungry for that hero. I'm not Democrat. I'm independent, by the way. But
right.
as I watched him, I was thinking, okay, well, this may be that
yep.
person who can pull the sword out of the stone for these progressives.
Yeah.
And I think the disappointment doesn't allow progressives to say, let's be honest about what we've got here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a piece of the article that I didn't write because it was long enough already would have said, if you want in the two-party system to have a real opposition here, the Democrats, and I am very, very distantly associated with Democrats now. I would almost describe myself as an independent now, except that the Republicans always seem to put up somebody so brutal and disgusting that I've only voted for one Republican in my life, and that was Lowell Weicker when he ran in Connecticut. But, you know, I do think that the Democrats, as the other party, as I sometimes call them, the party of Republicans are the party of privilege. The Democrats are the party of slightly less privilege. And, you know, if they want to be in opposition of any kind, they have to get over Obama. They have to get over the idea that this man whose idea of opposition is to say, wait for the Republicans, they'll get over the fever. Well, they didn't get over the fever in the debt ceiling crisis in 2011. They didn't get over the fever after the election, the midterm election of 2010, where he had already assured us that would happen. He is always moving towards the belief that he can co-opt people, that people can come together in the center. But where the center includes, you know, continuation of holding permanent detainees in a war on terror in violation of the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment and so on, you know, you have to say, no, you want a real opposition here, and you want somebody who will stand up for principle.
David, as I read what you've written, again, it's superb. We want to, I guess the easy out is to say, well, you know, he was molded, that this isn't really him, that this is the Wall Street Democrats, the holdover from the Clinton years, the Rubin crowd.
No, but he chose them.
That's my point. That's where you land with this. In other words, he had the right to say, I could have taken this other road. I could have taken this progressive road. I could have taken the kind of the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, White House, Sheldon Whitehouse kind of road. But this is where I ended up. And because this is what I wanted. That's inescapable when you really try to analyze these facts, isn't it?
I think so. And the signs were there not only in the choice of personnel for his economic team, but in taking Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. I don't think Hillary Clinton, I should add, has been at odds with what Obama wanted to do in foreign policy. I think she was, you know, she's farther toward an optimistic view of the war on terror and American force projection in the Middle East. That was plain in things she said about Iran during the primaries. I think she really believes those, the U.S. power. And it's plain in the way she and her group at the State Department pushed him to intervene with NATO and bomb Libya and overthrow a third government in the Middle East. I think what she is plain, and the fact that she didn't very much depart from his foreign policy is plain. But the choice of Hillary Clinton was so strange, given if you go back to the contest of the primaries and the general, given the fact that Obama had mainly defined himself against her on foreign policy.
Yes,
Hillary
yes.
Clinton and Obama don't have much disagreement on domestic policy. The difference was on foreign policy, and then he makes her head of the State Department, and he keeps Gates, who is the sort of softener of the acoustics on Cheney, and the one who probably held us back from a war with Iran in 2007, and that was a good thing Gates did.
Isn't it just a projection, though, David? When you take the totality of all this, it's a projection of this whole new Wall Street Democrat agenda. I mean, goes back to all the early days of Clinton. You know, let's move to the middle. Americans are middle. We got to get to the middle. We need Wall Street. We can't really care about the working poor, and we can really can't really pay that much attention to the middle class because
it's a technocratic, optimistic, neoliberal vision of how society can be improved by being guided by the intelligent rich. And the intelligent rich are very strongly identified with the interests of Goldman Sachs and a few other players like that. I agree. Clinton brought Wall Street into the White House, and Obama kept them there.
Yes, it secured their position even further with the failure to even prosecute the first one of them that stole it burned our economy down to the tune of $13 trillion. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from author David Bromwich. And if you want to support our show, make sure you subscribe to our weekly podcast. Sign up on our website at ringoffireradio.com. I'm Mike Papantonio. We're going to be right back. I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to the best of Ring of Fire. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. Right now, I'm talking with author and English professor David Bromwich about the evolution of Barack Obama from a good-hearted possible candidate that was going to mean something to this country to being just another corporate politician. David, let me move to this. So we have Hillary coming up. Now, this ties into Obama, I think, very cleanly. You've got the Democrats certainly at a point where they're at the fork in the road. They say, okay, do we go down this same path? Do we continue what Obama did, making the first Hillary, making the first Clinton years even stronger? Do we continue there? Do we opt for the Elizabeth Warren kind of idea that we've got to do more for this country, that we have to do bottom-up kind of building rather than top-down? Now, with Hillary, it's very clear what leadership wants, and it's the same leadership, even though, you know, I know you talk about this, everybody's clear on the Hillary camp and the Obama camp did not really get along all that well, but now they are getting along. So it's another projection of the early Clinton years, isn't it? Maybe you see this differently. I hope you do.
You know, to an amazing extent, I've come to think there is no Obama camp. It is a cult of personality, and the people who rallied around him, some of whom came over from Clinton, and some of whom are now ready to depart for Clinton again. I don't think he is a party player or a group actor at all, but his ideology and his practice in policy on financial regulation and so on, I agree, is not in reality much different from Hillary Clinton. And you got, you know, in other areas, if you think of his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, and where the policy of race to the top goes, which is not very different from Margaret Spelling's policy under Bush. It's a testing regime, and it's favoring charter schools. I mean, that, too, is another aspect of the sort of foundation-driven, technocratic idea of how you solve problems with the help of corporations. That Obama, I think, actually believes in, and it comes from what you can only call, you know, the elite presuppositions in his political thinking and his schooling, too. It occurred to me, thinking about what we know of the history, that Obama actually and his family, by which I mean his daughters, they've never been to a public school after his first 9 years of life. He went to the Punahou Academy in Honolulu, Occidental College in California, Columbia University, and Harvard Law School. The daughters went to the laboratory school and then in Chicago and then to Sidwell Friends. There is no history of public education in the Obama family, and that goes very nicely with the elite ideas about how education can be introduced from above by technocratic experts. That's just one example, but I think that's his real thinking, and it correlates with his experience.
If you were to pick out what are the very short list of where he said A and then did Z, where he tells us A, this is who I am, this is what I stand for, this is what I want to do for the country.
Well, I would say the worst of it is on the broad matter of accountability. That is to say, he came out against the abuses of the war on terror from the Iowa primary, where his victory catapulted him onto the national stage, as the cliche goes. And, you know, accountability, you must assume, for torture, rendition, also for breaking the law. That is to say, the warrantless surveillance that Michael Hayden, with Cheney's instructions, began, and so on. When Obama made his speech at the CIA assuring him that they would not be held accountable, that was an extraordinary decision. When he put on his website early on in his presidency that we're going to look forward and not backward, that was as much as to say to anybody who might have feared being held accountable, I won't be held accountable. And that, I think, from my point of view, which on this is constitutionalist and libertarian, that was to show real indifference towards the Constitution and the rule of law and to replace it by expedience. So I think that's the greatest single departure from
Dave, quickly on Wall Street, as soon as we saw Eric Holder, we knew what was up. Eric Holder, of course, coming from Covington Burling, Washington, D.C., a white-collar criminal firm
And also from the Janet Reno Justice Department.
Exactly. Okay, yeah. So tell me, when you saw that, what we heard him say, I got to do something about cleaning up Wall Street. They've got to be responsible. And then that's A, and then Z is what?
Well, the Z is that there has been very little prosecution of Wall Street delinquents. There has been some by the Security Exchange Commission, but that's not the same as the Justice Department. And in that, you have to feel Holder was following a very clear directive from Obama.
Yes,
we
yes.
can't afford to alienate.
Well, that was my next question. In other words, Holder didn't just do this. You meet with the president, you say, look, do we prosecute these white-collar criminals the same way we prosecute a young man who's selling 2 ounces of marijuana? And of course not. No, we let them go.
I don't think Holder operates independently of the president's will.
No, he certainly does not. David, I got to tell you, I interview a lot of people. This is the best handling of this presidency that I've seen so far. So,
well, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for joining me, okay?
Okay, bye-bye.
David Bromwich is a Sterling Professor of English at Yale University and author of the new book, Moral Imagination.
Coming up on Ring of Fire, Daniel Ellsberg will be joining us to talk about America's surveillance state. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and you're listening to Ring of Fire.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you've been listening to a free sample of Ring of Fire Radio. If you'd like to listen to the full show, subscribe to our weekly podcast at our website at ringoffireradio.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air.